You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Broken records, the albums you wouldn't shut up about. Broken records, the music our guests can't live without.
Like Judy,
Barbara,
Liza,
Bette,
Betty,
Audra,
Bernadette.
We broadcast this podcast with hopes that someday we might get Patti LuPone.
Welcome to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World. I'm Ben Rimmelauer, and I'm here with my lovely co-host, Daniel Nolan.
Hey, y'all. Today's guest is drag legend Russ King, a.k.a. Miss Richfield 1981.
Miss Richfield 1981 is one of the most popular and enduring stars of the Provincetown summertime entertainment circuit. In fact, the must-see act in Provincetown, according to the New York Post.
Her live performances regularly sell out. Repeat engagements in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, San Diego, Philly, Atlanta, Florida, and Minneapolis. And she is one of the most popular shows on Atlantis Cruises.
Miss Richfield has been on a plethora of TV shows, from The Tonight Show with Jay Leno to Cake Boss on TLC. And she is internationally recognized as the television spokesperson for travel company Orbitz.
We are obsessed with her because she is the master of audience interaction, and her shows achieve a rare synergy of performer and spectator that transcends the realm of nightclub entertainment.
Hear, hear. I couldn't have said it better myself.
I know, that's why you gave me that line.
Okay, tell the folks at home what you love about Miss Richfield, Daniel.
I love her irreverence. She's never afraid to push the envelope. There are some things that she has said on that stage that nobody else would be able to get away with. And she not only gets away with it, but is applauded and celebrated for it. And that is what I love in a drag queen.
It's so true. It's funny because people talk so much. I mean, they used to talk about PC and sort of complain about things having to be PC.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, you know, it's a lot of the opposite, where we're like, no, goddammit, PC was actually right. Like, you know, we want the world to be, like, a safe space for people to live in, you know? And, like, and you find that the people that complain about that most tend to be the ones who then get their panties in the biggest bunch if it doesn't go their way. It just threatens their, you know, entitlement or whatever, privilege. But there's something just special about Miss Richfield, where I've just never seen anyone buckle at her brashness, you know?
Right. And it's done, the energy in the room is one of love, and it's not, she's not, like, roasting people. It's not, like, a hateful energy. It's a very, gracious, you know, we're laughing together, we're here having this moment, sharing this moment together, and it's interesting she chose, the Free to Be You and Me album because it's...
I didn't even think of that.
It's very much like we're celebrating our freakdom together, we're all outsiders.
Definitely not the same!
Not the same! So,
by the way, that thing that we constantly say, we just tell the two people in the audience that don't get it, which I'll let you tell them.
Well, it is the final monologue, I guess, from Barbara Streisand.
Oh, it's not a teleprompter, it's a monologue, that's for sure.
It's right after she says something about the problems of life in our big cities, which is just the broadest, least intelligent thing I've ever heard her say. But
I think Donald Trump says it now.
truly. So, anyway, but Miss Richfield's someone who doesn't mind making fun of the things that most people, you know, like you're saying, get their panties in a bunch about. It's like RuPaul says, you know, drag is about not taking yourself too seriously. And Miss Richfield and others like her remind us of that. And it's all about fun. And especially somewhere like P-Town, where you're already, you go for a vacation, you go to relax. It's she and people like Dina and Varla just help you to sink into that warm bath of
I mean, when you vacation. See Miss Richfield coming up Commercial Street on her little scooter.
Oh, absolutely.
With her, like, 7 foot, like, 1950s Tupperware party hair.
That makeup.
And those crazy makeup, those enormous glasses.
Yeah.
Just honking. And does she ride side saddle or something? I feel like she's always, like, akimbo.
She is akimbo. You know, I was just thinking, I had a visual just now of Elaine Stritch walking down, you know, Central Park West in her fur coat and her hose. It's like, Miss Richfield has a similar, not silhouette, but a similar
energy.
Vibe and
yeah.
energy.
Because the only difference is Miss Richfield's kidding and Elaine Stritch
is
freaking serious.
Totally.
That's very true.
But, you know, very lanky, very, just happy and unique and maybe, well, maybe that doesn't fit Elaine, the happy part, but you know, just free to be you and me.
Well, it's like, it's like, even if Elaine was angry or unhappy, there was something sort of, like, buoyant. Is
a
that
spring
the right
in
word?
Her step. Yeah, yes. Definitely totally. A spring. I mean, maybe that was the Bloody Mary she had with breakfast. You never know. But
it was a Cosmo, and it was at lunch.
As she says in Broadway the Golden Age, I never got into that drugstore scene. I was going to saloons.
No strawberry phosphates for Miss Stritch.
That's right, honey. So how are you? What's going on? How's life?
Life is good. I'm just so happy to be here during the gay games.
The gay games.
Back to Barbara Streisand, the concert. Streisand, like the sand on the ocean. Sand on the ocean.
Sand on the ocean.
I'm a little wonky because I got up at 5 in the morning to fly in from Cincinnati
right.
this morning.
Oh, and we should mention, we've thrown you a bit, listeners for a loop because we just did Broadway Con with Judy Kuhn, which was a great success.
It was magical.
But unbeknownst to us, the audio will not be available until tomorrow or the next day. So
going back to our original schedule of having Miss Richfield tomorrow.
And then Judy Kuhn will close out season one in, you know.
Yes.
In a wonderful finale episode. And then we will continue with season two after that.
Yes. Yes, we will. And we're very excited about season two.
Yes.
I can't give it all away, but if the name Nina Small sounds good to you.
Nina Smalls. Wait, who's that? What's
the Tony winning star of Schmed Schmig.
And the Schmangry Schmitch. I mean, we do have, I mean, so far, the lineup we have is they're all legends, and you know them well, and we adore them, and, you know, also we're putting out, again, the, what's the word, like, call to arms to send in your Dolly Concert Kill submissions.
Yes, please. We so enjoyed the Dolly Concert Kill submissions that you sent in, mm-hmm. and we would like to enjoy even more of them.
Yes, and we will, at the end of this segment, we will be reading and replying to a couple of those. So
maybe we should give each other a couple.
Okay.
Let's play the game.
Let's play
the
game.
Let's
do the work.
Throw down.
Do the work.
That's what it's all about, the work.
Okay, you give me one first.
That's not usually how we play.
Okay, I'm going to give you one that is in keeping with the theme of the last couple episodes, so it's going to be good.
Okay.
Okay, Dolly Concert Kill.
Dolly Concert Kill.
Miss Richfield,
Miss
1981.
Richfield, 1981.
Varla Jean Merman.
Oh, really?
And,
all drag.
And, Dina Martina.
Oh, this is hard. Okay, well, you know I love me some Varla,
mm-hmm.
but I really want to see Miss Richfield as Dolly Levi.
Sure.
Because I really think she is really right for the part. Like, and I would want her to have that scooter involved.
Yeah,
but I really want, like, I want her to come down the stairs on one of those, like, scooters that goes down a
yeah, like,
stair.
Honking a horn.
Yeah. I think she would be a spectacular
yeah,
Dolly.
Totally.
As a matter of fact, like, what are we doing sitting here? Let's produce Hella Dolly and P-Town next summer, starring Miss Richfield.
Totally.
Varla would actually be very good as
Irene Malloy.
Down my back, yeah. And then, as you know, as I've said before, I would like to see Dina Martina in concert every night of my life.
Totally.
And I don't ever need that to change, and I will continue to want that.
Totally.
Even in the game.
Totally.
So, okay, now I give you.
Sure.
Okay. I'm so tired. Let's just go to sleep. okay, so I would give you, then, in keeping with the game we've been playing.
Uh-huh, the gay game.
I would give you Judy Kuhn.
Okay.
I would give you Faith Prince.
Uh-huh.
And I would give you Linda Etter.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
I know you were hoping I'd say Cara Lee, but I'm not going to make it that easy on you.
No, that'd be too easy. Okay, I will say I have to see Faith Prince as Dolly. You know, her comedic chops would really come in handy, and after seeing her cabaret show in P-Town, I know that she is very right for the part.
She is.
The way the audience just worshipped her. And then I would have to see... I'd have to see Judy in concert,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
voice. And then we saw Linda in concert in Provincetown, which was fabulous. But unfortunately, I'll have to send Linda on a little vacation.
Oh, you're giving yourself the Dolly concert chill version rather than the full kill?
Yeah, well, whatever vacation means to you, you know.
Well, death is the ultimate vacation.
Listen, honey.
Some say you're gay. Okay, so one more round. Well, now
let's go to the submissions.
Okay, yes, let's.
All right, Ben, so I have some Dolly concert kills.
DCK!
DCK submitted from our listeners. So first off, we are going...
He's pulling these out of his brazier. Oh, no, I see. It's on the screen.
Oh, yeah, out of my digital brazier. So the first is a friend of the pod, Sam Durbin, a.k.a. Brianna Banana, out of Chicago, Illinois.
Is that the boy from the beach?
No, it's my other friend, Sam. This is so my friend, Sams. Sam, who I went to college with. He sent us a lot, and they're all categorized.
Oh, my.
So we'll work our way through them week after week. But
okay.
We're going to start off with 70s divas.
Yes.
He sent us three 70s divas. Okay. Cher, mm-hmm. Diana Ross, mm-hmm. Elton John. Mm. So I'll let you go first.
I would see Cher as Dolly. I would see Diana in concert, and I would kill Elton.
Yeah, I have to do the same. I mean, I would like to see Diana as Dolly, but not...
Why?
Not more than Cher.
I mean, I could see
star.
Diana in something,
you know, she's a
but
star.
I don't know if she'd be funny in Dolly.
She probably wouldn't be funny. Cher would be funnier, but I like to, I will. I want to hear Diana sing those songs more, because Diana, I like her voice more. But I mean, Cher walking down that staircase in that headdress, which already is so Cher.
It's already so Cher.
Yeah, so I have to do that. Kill Elton. Okay, next from Sam Durbin, we have Living Legends.
Mm.
Cheetah Rivera, mm-hmm. Angela Lansbury, and Julie Andrews.
Cheetah, Angela, and Julie. This is so hard. Okay, well, I have seen Cheetah and... No. I've seen Cheetah in concert.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen Cheetah and Angela in shows. And I think I've been lying and saying that I saw Julie and Victor Victoria, but I definitely didn't.
Did you see Liza?
No. But I didn't need to. Okay, so I think, though, the question is, my gut is like, all things being equal, I'd rather see Cheetah's Dolly than the other people's Dolly, because it's more in her musical comedy wheelhouse. But I think I'm, like, punishing Angela for A Little Night Music.
Oh.
I mean, I obviously love Angela, but the fact that I would even say Dolly is more in her wheelhouse than Angela's is insane, right? Like, what's the wheelhouse of Dolly if not the wheelhouse of
Jerry Herman leading lady?
Right? So, like, shouldn't... But I keep thinking of how Angela just, like, was sort of, like, not quite on the money in Night Music. And also, I've seen Cheetah in the costume because of Jerry's Girls, and
sure.
It just feels like it just so right.
Yeah.
I just see her, like... Can you
imagine the little jig she would do?
Yeah, I can. But then I'm also kind of like, bitch, I've seen it. Mm. Like... How about Julie Andrews? Like, I mean, she's the real, like...
Dolly will never go away again.
A little bit more like, Dolly will never go away!
Yeah, a little of Fräulein Maria spunk.
I mean, but, like, even if you take out, like, the vocal, like, I just feel like... I mean, Julie more than Angela or Cheetah.
Mm-hmm.
The way that Bette walked down the stairs and you're like, fuck you, Patti LuPone. Like, just like, Julie could come down the stairs and just be like, oh, Broadway.
I mean, she does have, like, the graceful, gracious presence that would completely change the role for me.
I mean, when she went away from the lights of 14th Street.
Into my personal haze.
It's so, come on. I mean, you kind of want it.
I mean,
although
you're kind of convincing
me. It'd be the first time that there was ever a Dolly where instead of being like, put back the Merman song, world, take me back.
Yeah.
You're like, put back the random Merman ballad I can't remember.
Yeah, and also give her Ribbons on My Back. Come on.
For fuck's sake. Right. Kate, really? Kate Baldwin's going to sing that when Julie Andrews
right,
is backstage
right.
drinking Gatorade? So I'm going to have to go with Julie Dolly.
Oh, my.
And then Angela in concert. Because you know what?
Oh, this
it's about fucking time,
such
Angie.
Such a turn. Yes.
How long is she going to make us wait?
I mean, I feel like forever. Although
it's not too damn late.
We hear those rumors. There's that album somewhere hidden away, right?
Well, how about we make the album live now?
Oh, can you imagine?
Go to the Carlisle. Go to 54 Below. Mm. One night only at the Gershwin. I don't care.
I would pay.
The Winter Garden. Like, I didn't. Would not care if she came out and she was like, light the candles. She could talk sing
light
the entire
the
night.
Candles. Yeah.
I don't care if she's got a teleprompter and three music stands and an ear. You know?
Yeah.
And then Cheetah, I mean, God bless her. Some of my most thrilling nights have been watching Cheetah, but
sure.
They've already happened.
Right, right.
Sorry, I'm going to have to say sorry, Cheetah.
All right, Cheetah. I mean, this has taken such a turn. My initial instinct, hands down, no questions, was Angela S. Dolly, Julie in concert, and Kill Cheetah, but I mean, you've really convinced me now that I need to see Julie as Dolly because I just need to see it.
I mean, even
Angela's,
if you just go
I
by
mean,
comparison's sake,
name. Mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of know what Angela's Dolly would be like.
Right.
And, like, you have no idea what Angela's concert would be like. She might teach
That's
you
right.
something about singing.
That's
Whereas
right.
Julie's concert, you know exactly
what
it would
be like.
Exactly what
it would be like, yeah. That's true. I mean, you've convinced me. I'm going to have to do Julie Dolly as well. Angela in concert. Still Kill Cheetah.
Pleasure doing business with
yes.
you.
Thank you, Sam Durbin. That was quite the submission.
Quite.
All right. That was fun. Please keep your submissions coming. You can send them to brokenrecordspod@gmail.com. And now, without further ado, let's talk to Miss Richfield 1981.
Here's Miss Richfield 1981.
Broken record, broken record, broken record.
I think I brought a copy in Braille. I'll just
we're busting our gut laughing at Russ King, aka Miss Richfield 1981. Fabulous, the must-see show in Provincetown for how many years?
Oh my goodness, such an introduction. My gosh, I'm glowing over here. I wish we weren't on the radio so you could see my bright smiley face. Well, blog, radio. You know, I'm an old queen. It's radio to me.
It's radio.
Yeah, if there's no visual, it's radio, sweetie. It's reel-to-reel tape to me.
Well, you've got a face for TV,
Ampex,
not radio.
Yeah, I'm going, yeah, right. That never sadly was the case, even when I was younger. But I've been in Provincetown. This is the end of my 17th season, which is so hard to believe. I think Varla's been here for 21 years and Dina 15. And there's just been a little group of us that have really understood, you know, the value of it is just beyond belief. I mean, it's why I can be a full-time artist. Mm. If I didn't have Provincetown, I wouldn't be a full-time artist.
And there's no other town like this, is there?
You know, I try to drive that home. To the homosexuals, you know, of whom I am one, or of which I am one. I'm not sure how to say that correctly. But, and my background's in writing, sadly.
Having walked down commercial to get here, I definitely think it's a witch, not a whom.
Yeah.
Based on what we're...
Is it an it? I'm not sure. Anyway, but, you know, the weird thing about it is that I just don't think people realize how fortunate we are. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a handful of us that really do... but I just don't think the journal community has a clue how fortunate we are to have this, because you can use the word unique very seldom. As writers, you know, we know, you know, the words we're not supposed to use, and that's one of them. You know, we shouldn't say unique, because really, you know, nothing's unique. And I say this would be the one exception in my life, because there really is, and dare I say, nothing worldwide like this. Mm-hmm. And that's freaky when you think about that. I'm a cog in this wheel is like amazing to me that I can have the privilege. And I always tell people it's not who's most talented. It's, you know, it's a lot of it's timing, a lot of it's stick-to-itiveness, a lot of it's where you are in life. You know, I was able to pick everything up and just move for the summer. You know, if I had kids, I wouldn't have done that. You know, if I had a partner, I probably wouldn't have done that. But, you know, I was just able to do that and get myself out of, I was in a terrible financial state. And when I came, I didn't have money for a hotel. So when I put the shit and the two cats into my little pickup truck and sailed out here the first time, I had to sleep in parking lots because I didn't have enough money for
it. And where was the gig that you were doing then?
It was at the Crown and Anchor. And that's where I started.
I think that's where I saw you the first time.
Yeah, I saw
in
you
the cabaret where Dean is now.
Oh, I saw you in the big room there.
Yes, in the big room. I ended up going, I was in, I worked 7 days a week in the height of the season for those, that fat 10 weeks that we have. Mm-hmm. I would work 7 days a week. I would do Showgirls on Monday to advertise my show. So that was really essential.
Oh, was Showgirls originally your thing?
No, but it was at the Crown originally. Ah, okay. And so I, you know, got into that and just that was good advertising and good visibility. Then I would do my show Tuesday, and then I would do karaoke for 3 hours on Wednesday. Then I would do Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then Monday I would do, you know, Showgirls, and Tuesday I would do a show. And I mean, I just did that. And I was 41 when I started, and 57.
And but you're such an institution in P-Town now. And, you know,
it's another word for old, but thank you.
No, but I mean, when you were the wee age of 41. I mean, but having this when this was your first summer here, how did you sell that many nights?
You know what? A lot of it is timing. And I think Dina and I were both privileged to start at a time where Provincetown wasn't as busy. I think when, I don't know what it was like when Varla first started. That would have been another, you know, whatever, 5 years or 4 years before me. I guess it was 4 years before I started. But when I got here, it was a hand of God moment because I had been trying to get in for 4 years. That was the fourth summer that I finally got in. And Tropical Joe's had closed, which was a bar with entertainment. Mm-hmm. The Vixen, which is now the Pilgrim House where I perform, had changed hands.
Oh, somebody was
so that wasn't being wasn't being used because they were kind of changing hands and changing management. So there really wasn't much going on here. There was no art house. There was no theater. Mm-hmm. There was no almost nothing at Town Hall. There would be like one thing at Town Hall all season or two things. They'd have maybe something on the 4th of July and something for Carnival and that would be it. Now there's something there like every week practically and sometimes two shows. And that's 750 seats. And so now there, so the only places that were doing shows when I started in Provincetown was the beautiful and fabulous Post Office Cafe, which has been here for a long, long time, has a long history, and that's where Varla was. And then, and Jimmy James was there when I first got here, and then the Crown and Anchor. So it was only like four shows at the most. There would be like four shows a night. Now there's like up to 18 or 19 shows a night, and there's 25 acts in town any
that's
given
so
week.
Crazy.
Wow.
And so it's hard to make a living. It's not so hard for us because we have, we're established.
Right. Yeah.
But the newer people, I just, you know, tell them, hey, you know, hang in there. It wasn't as tough for us. Because we just didn't have the competition. So I don't know today,
but
would I make
you,
it? I don't even know.
But you created this, in a sense. I mean, you know.
But it was a much, much easier
but it, but
way
that's
to
not,
do it.
You can say that, but, you know, I mean, for example, if you were to go to Fire Island or Rehoboth and try to create what has happened here.
Oh,
I mean, it's almost
no.
like life developing on Earth. What were the perfect storm that this happened?
This developed back like in the 50s, you know, when it was really a difficult place to get to. It was almost impossible to get here. Property was nothing because nobody could, you know, families would just walk away from houses because it was so difficult to get here. And then, and that's how Key West was. They were impossible to get there. So that's where the gays went, you know, because they could hold hands and they could go on the beach. They had a private beach and all that. Yeah.
I never thought about the geographical difficulties as being what made it a gay scene.
And that's what made it a gay scene. And the unfortunate part of it, of the situation, is that Key West developed into more B&Bs, which are fabulous. That's certainly nothing to say anything bad about that. But people spend their time in B&Bs, clothing optional, and they're super fun. They have pools and they're fabulous. But Provincetown never really got into that. And so people spent their time on the beach and on the street. And it just kind of pushed everybody out. And then because it's the land of Divine, you know, performed here in Wayland Flowers and Madam.
Right.
And, you know, word was Judy Garland showed up at different times. And so it has this amazing history of talent. And then, again, not anything I did, but people started doing shows. Then people started, you know, doing five nights a week. And
when you started, were there, was there a regular, were there regular acts the way that you and Dina and Varla are now?
There already were, because, you know, Varla's been here 21 years, and it was existed before she got here, too.
But who were the people, who was the generation before you?
That would be a question to ask Varla and to ask old-timers in town, because there was Musty Chiffon, and there was, I'm trying to think of some of the older ones that I don't know, but people, I hear the names come up from time to time, people have good memories of them, and you know, and a lot of what Provincetown is, to me at least, is, you know, a lot of the characters really come to life on the street as well, so it's not like you're buying a ticket and you walk in, and, you know, somebody comes on stage and then you walk out of theater and it's over, like you would a Broadway show or anything else or most plays. But it's a little different because, you know, you walk down the street and, you know, you might run into Varla, you might run into Leah Delaria, you might run into, who knows, right?
Yeah.
You know, somebody from Drag Race or, you know, it's pretty fascinating and different. And that's where it just doesn't exist. That's why I try to pound into people's heads is it does not exist anywhere else. There just is nowhere else where you go on vacation and, A, you have that many opportunities to see shows, but also that people just go. People just plan to see three shows while they're here.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anywhere else. And even in Key West, as much fun as it is, and I love Key West, they're not really show-based.
No.
We tried to do that, and it didn't work, because it really just isn't really part of the, you know, they go to a bar and see a show, but they don't really, they're not really, it's, they don't have the, buying tickets. Theater Latte Dots down there with Randy Roberts and Christopher Peterson.
Oh, sure, yeah.
They're wonderful. I just saw Randy the other day, and, you know, they're amazing, but it's a much smaller thing. You know, here it's like, my God, you can't walk down the street, but you're accosted by somebody with a postcard.
Yeah.
And then not to mention mail call at the post office, which is a mail menu.
Oh, yeah, we keep saying we're going to go see this.
It's so good. And then Erotic is new.
What's the Cirque? There's a Cirque
show.
That's
like
a Cirque show,
kind of.
Yeah.
It's an aerial show.
Yeah.
The mail call boys are amazing dancers. And they do, I think they might have a little nudity. I don't know.
I think
not always.
Is, yeah.
But but you hope for that, at least.
And then, I know.
Because you're really close. It's the post office. But there's not a lot of space to fly up there. It's, you know,
right.
So, you know, I think Varla used to call it the Anne Frank, you know, annex or something. You know, you're up in the sky.
Yes,
like,
it
attic,
is
you know?
That.
So, anyway, and they, but mail call's more dancing and that sort of thing, and they're really talented guys. And then Erotic is aerial. So they're in the gymnasium at the high school.
And I mean, all this stuff, you know, and even, I mean, shows like yours and Dina's and Varla's, I mean, and even, I guess, some of the RuPaul queens, although that could be all over the map, but was the tradition to have this, I mean, you know, to call this drag is almost diminishing of what it is, because you guys are really doing, first of all, it's kind of high art in terms of performance art and variety show, and it's just, it's so fully conceptualized and executed. It's not just somebody in a dress, you know, lip-syncing or telling dick jokes or something.
Well,
you know?
I think it's a...
Although, you know, I'm here for any dick
course.
Jokes to be told.
We're all here for that. But, you know, art, and where you can't see this in a blog, but we're all putting that in air quotes. But the art piece of it is, to me, fascinating to watch the fluidity of it. Because, you know, there was the time with the, you look at Charles Pierce, or you look at even back, and I should have, like, remembered all these names. I'm trying to think of Sheridan Square. There was...
Charles Ludlum.
Charles, that's what I'm trying to say, yes.
All the Charleses.
All the
Charles
Bush. Charles Bush, yeah. And these guys, you know, were amazing, and they were really the ones who, I think, set the stage for the rest of us to be able to do what we do. Otherwise, I don't know who would have come up
with
it.
But they weren't doing weekly shows
in
P-Town, also.
No, they weren't in P-Town.
So you guys really, you guys made that happen here, where there's like a...
Well, we didn't, but some our four mothers and fathers did. But they were the... Actually, those other guys are really the... If you were looking at the beginning of it, I think were the beginning of shows, you know? You look at the Charles Bushes and people that wrote plays and, you know, were on stage as women, but sometimes funny, sometimes not. You know, sometimes, you know, just... It was amazing to look at the history of it, and it blows me away, because I feel like, you know, sometimes you feel accomplished, like, oh, you know, I've done this for a lot of years and stuff, and then I look at that and I just, like, become appreciative and gracious and, like, oh my gosh, and you realize these people who've, like, you know, really, at times where it was much harder, you know, laid out you know, the red carpet for you to walk down. Yeah. You know, they didn't have the red carpet.
I but mean, they might say, in some of the ways that you say it was easier for you starting out than it might be for someone now,
yeah.
they might say that about themselves and compare
some
to you.
And at that era, too, yeah. in New York, where, you know, live performance was everything.
Yeah,
you know, they just
exactly.
didn't have, it was before, it was, you know, there certainly weren't computers. And it's interesting to watch the evolution of it and the fluidity of it now with the RuPaul girls
yeah.
and see... Mm-hmm. You know, the era of Jinx Monsoon and Ben de la Creme,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, it's fun to watch them get their voices.
Mm-hmm.
Now Jinx is going to be on the road with, I think, Xanadu. I think she's in Xanadu.
Oh, right,
oh,
yes.
Wow.
That's and another RuPaul queen is
yeah.
they're doing the two, is it the Mary Testa and Jackie Hoffman characters, right?
And, yes, and Bianca Del Rio took a position
oh,
in
we
a
We saw her in
yeah,
something
in the
everybody's
West
talking
End.
About Jamie. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
We saw Michelle.
Oh no, we saw Michelle. I got Michelle
the other
and Bianca confused.
Well,
but Michelle took over the
Rita Baker. It's all
literally.
The same
thing. Well, speaking of the inspirations though, and this kind of variety stuff, I mean, it's fitting
yeah.
that you would be doing this. I love that the album you wanted to talk about was Free to Be You and Me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which, I mean, it really, it feels very Miss Richfield to
me. Doesn't it?
You know, I mean, it has its heart and really in the
yeah.
right place in terms of the messaging. And I had known it. You know, growing up in, like, liberal Jewish kind of L.A.,
yeah.
that was the thing that was sort of like, oh, yeah, like, you know, the kindergarten teachers wanted you to listen to this record. But it was wonderful reading about it and seeing how controversial it was and how much,
yeah.
you know, like, reactionary bullshit there was. You know, but it makes sense in terms of that and then in terms of the variety aspect and just, like, the silliness and,
mm-hmm.
and the... you know, all that, the full performance
yeah.
beat of it, it would be so...
Well, 1972, which
yeah.
is so crazy
yeah.
to me. It doesn't...
Yeah.
Well, for some of us, it doesn't seem... Because I was born in 62, so I was 10 when it came out. But I just am amazed at what society was like
mm-hmm. yeah.
in 1972,
mm-hmm.
which,
yeah.
I you know, it's weird. And we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of Stonewall,
yeah.
and I would have been 7 at that point. And I was a news hound as a kid, always. And always we watched the evening news.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Minneapolis, in Richfield, Minnesota. Yes.
The real Richfield.
The real Richfield. Richfield, Minnesota. Yes, the first suburb of Minneapolis. And it was a very much a working class suburb, but it was really very mixed. There wasn't any... I remember it was a very... you know, but there was some wealthy people. It was kind of a wealthy, little wealthy neighborhood. For the most part, we all grew up in like 700 square foot homes, you know,
mm-hmm.
small Cape Cods that everybody had 4 to 6 children, you know, with one bathroom. And that's just how everybody grew up. Nobody thought any differently. Now you would never grow up in a house that small with all those kids. You would just move to a bigger house because, or move someplace where you could afford to live. But at the time, Richfield was, an interesting place to grow up because it was very mixed. And so we had where I was going with that was we had a music teacher, and we had a growing school district at the time. Like each class was like 1,000 kids. So it was a big place.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it was a powerhouse for sports and things like that. We always had a football team that was
mm-hmm.
going to state and hockey and all the other things. And so it was a fun place to grow up and crowded. You know, it was more city-ish in the sense that, you know, it was the schools were crowded.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So you didn't go to school in, you know, in a tiny little place. You went to school in a great big place. And I remember we just had a lot of young teachers. So, and a lot of our teachers were Jewish. I had, you know, Miss Abrams for kindergarten and Mrs. Feldman for 3rd grade and Mr. Goldman for 6th grade. And we had this really cool music teacher, Paige Macklin. And I wanted to Google her, and I'll have to do this at some point because I bring her up in my show. She was this, you know, long-haired, kind of, you know, tie-dyed, you know, free to be you and me gal, you know. She had this really cool husband. They lived really close to the school. And I think she might have had her first child when she was teaching with us. So they were very young. They were just starting a family. And she just liked new music. And so...
Mm-hmm.
When this was airing on television, because it was created in 72 as an album,
mm-hmm.
Marlo
mm-hmm.
Thomas and her friends, I mean, Marlo Thomas really produced it, I think, and did, as you can see, a lot
yeah.
of the work, with famous, you know, composers
yeah.
and performers. I mean, it's just a list of who's who at the time. And and she, then they made it into an animated TV special, and when that aired, we were doing the music as a spring concert in
oh,
elementary
cool.
school, which was... pretty advanced.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And it got a real mixed review from the parents, but you know, and I sang the song William Wants a Doll, which was a song that Alan Alda and Marlo Thomas sang.
When my friend William was 5 years old, he wanted a doll to hug and hold.
A doll,
said William,
is what I need to wash and clean and dress and feed. A doll to give a bottle to and put to bed when day is through. And any time my doll gets ill, I'll take good care of it,
said my friend Bill.
A doll, William wants a doll. Don't be a sissy, said his best friend did. Why should a boy want to play with a doll? Dolls are for girls, said his cousin Fred.
Don't be a jerk, said his older brother. I know what to do, said his father to his mother. So his father...
How old were you?
Well, I was in, you know, in the show, I say I was in fifth grade, but I think I was in sixth grade now.
But
that
that's still, I mean, that's very close to home.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's the story I tell in my show, because my show this year is called Gender Fluids.
Yes, we love that.
Yes. And so at the end of the show, I play the musical Saw, always. Uh-huh. And then that's usually sort of a poignant moment, because mm-hmm. it's pretty. And, it's a little, one thing I've learned about the Saw, it's a little gimmicky. So you only want to do like a verse. You know, so it's a little short thing. And so I play a verse and the chorus and then I sing it. But I, before I introduce it and I say how important it was to me to have this Free to Be You and Me album. And mm-hmm. I never owned the album, believe it or not. As important as this was in my life and as life changing as this was, never owned the album. My parents would not have bought that for me.
Really?
And, oh my God, they were conservative. It was a conservative Protestant upbringing in my home, and we were more conservative than our church. The church we went to was relatively conservative, but my family was much more conservative than the church. Like, my family had rules that the church didn't have.
But they didn't mind you singing that song in school. Yeah.
Well, they didn't know until I sang it in the concert. And I didn't say anything because we didn't talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, my father could have been less interested. And so they came to the spring concert, and then I ended up, and I said, oh, I have a solo, you know. And it never even dawned on me to tell them what it was. Although, I remember when I sang it, you know, when I first saw the music, and the music teacher was teaching me this, and she had given me the solo. Uh-huh. Like, I didn't have to audition.
She was
doing. Oh, yeah. She was like... Like, straight from Central Casting. Like, uh-huh. this kid is going to sing that song.
She was and like, you can put this in your show in P-Town later.
I have a feeling this is going to be mean a lot more to you later in life when you look back on it. And so I was at that point, you know, when you're in sixth grade, even fifth, sixth grade, you're at the point where you're still playing with toys, but you're not playing with toys.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I think kids are different today, but, you know, back in the day, we didn't have video games and stuff like that unless you went to a video arcade,
right.
you know, and
Pinball.
Actually played, right, or Pac-Man or something. I'm not even sure when that came out, but I remember we, you know, so we played, and I grew up in a neighborhood largely with girls, and I so, of course, connected with girls, so that worked out perfect for me. The story I tell on my show is that I sang William Wants a Doll, and it meant a lot to me because I knew a little boy who wanted to play with dolls, you know, and as I'm speaking as Miss Richfield, you know, and then I say, you know, I knew that boy really, really well, and then I wink and sort of touch my nose, you know, sort of like people are clued in like, oh, this is a story about you,
yeah.
you know, and then I tell about how when I was a kid, I was playing with dolls with the girls next door and got in trouble, and was told that isn't what boys do, you know, and my mother told my father, and, you know, it turned into a, and I don't remember how old I was, because at that point in your life, it's all a blur, you know, memories, especially when you get into your late 50s, like, you know, it's a blur, the childhood, but I mean, I was probably like in first grade, you know, and I remember my mother saying, why do you always play with girls? Why don't you play with the boys, you know, and she had at one point, because the school I went to was on a really busy street, and she had been walking down the street to the store or something like that, and she said, yeah, I saw you on the playground today. I just, you know, was walking by, going to the store, and you were playing with the girls. And it was just like, what are you... And I remember even as, like... And I only went to that school through first grade, and then I changed schools. So I know it had to be kindergarten or first grade, and I, even as that young of a child, I remember thinking... Why were you watching me at school playing that beat up? It's like creepy. Like, what are you doing? And she said, you know, why don't you play with the boys? And then when I played with dolls with the girls, that was really it, you know. Mm. And so then it taught me, as like a little kid, I had to be somebody else.
Right.
Yeah. Like I couldn't, which, you know, you guys can probably connect to, and anybody who's gay or lesbian or, you know, probably people of color can relate to these types of things too, where you just learn you can't be who you want to be.
Mm. But did
you be somebody else?
What did it mean to you then to have a teacher and an album by a television star that was telling you a very different message?
Well, amazing. And then to have, I mean, to have an album was amazing, but to have it on television was really kind of it, because we were the television generation, right? Mm-hmm. That we did grow up on.
Yeah.
Believe me, like, that is what our parents did. They sat us in front of a television so they didn't have to deal with us.
Yeah.
And then it became obvious that that wasn't good for kids. But that was after me. Like, I was in that generation.
They didn't even feel
like,
bad about doing it.
You can watch as much TV as you want. Just don't bother your father and I.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so we, like, watched TV all the time as kids. And, you know, Star Trek and, you know, all of the, when it was new, you know, the original one.
That was kind of my thing too, though. I mean,
it was like amazing.
When now the screen time limits and stuff that my friends and my sister have for their
kids. Oh my God, how bad it was for our
eyes. We were 24/7. I had TV in my room.
We were by the airport and without a remote control. So we would take turns sitting right next to the television to turn the volume up as the planes were going through our house.
That's so funny. Because
it was so friggin' loud and it would shake the walls.
Did you have to adjust the antenna and everything?
Yeah, we had to do that, although I don't remember doing that as much. I think because we were so close to the city.
Oh, you were getting all the signals.
We got all the signals near the airport, I'm sure, you know, we were getting whatever we needed. But we did have to sit and turn the volume up and turn the volume down.
Yeah.
So we're sitting like 4 inches from the television. I'm sure like my eyes are probably like got permanent damage from years of sitting 4 inches from the television. But it was really meaningful to me to have this music, and then to see it on television was really amazing, because television really made things legitimate.
Yeah.
For me.
Right.
Well, you know, also, an album was great.
10,000 channels. So if something was on TV,
oh my God,
that was a chosen select, you know.
And when we were kids, I remember in first grade, Sesame Street was sort of new, and they were trying to encourage us to do Sesame Street. And, I tried it. First of all, we could hardly get channel 2 was our public television, so we could hardly get it in. You had the round, because then you had the round antenna that you had to work with, not the arms.
Oh, right, the UHF.
I don't know what.
Do you even know what those were?
So we're looking at this, right, and it's just like, we can barely get the thing in, it's a little snowy, and then it's just a kid thing, it's the baby thing, and so it was like, oh, this doesn't work. 2 years earlier, it would have, like, preschool would have been perfect.
Sure.
You know, it would have really helped us. We were still looking at picture books, and I kid you not, in first grade.
Yeah.
Now, we were reading, but we were also looking at picture books.
Yeah.
Because I have my Dick and Jane.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I still have my, and my neighbor, when they had moved, found it, and it had Russell on that, like, I had written my name on it. And she's like, you are not going to believe what I found, because, you know, she was in college and her parents were selling the house and they were moving. They were good Mormons. They moved out to Utah. And and they gave me this book and I was like, holy smokes, that was first grade.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Now it would be like preschool at the best. But I just remember the Free to Be You and Me wasn't a baby thing. You know, that was like something. And when that came on television, you know, we only essentially had ABC, NBC, and CBS. That was it. Mm-hmm. So this is a big freaking deal to put something
and
on
Marlo
TV.
And Marlo Thomas was a huge
And she was a, yes. And so she had done That Girl. Yeah. She was Danny Thomas's daughter, which also put her on the map. And then, and then her social justice work really put her on the map, too. Between St. Jude's and her father's work and her work with Gloria Steinem and, you know, all the women that did all of that important work and putting their money where their mouth was, you know, and being counted.
And did you, I mean, to see, you know, for all the, I mean, I'm just thinking back, I mean, in terms of, like, before it was acceptable, you know, to be gay and everything in America, you know, there was, feminism had more traction than the gay rights movement had, and that was all coming from the same record. So in a way, I mean, I think, you know, I didn't know the album so well, but I think it would have been encouraging to me, even if all my teachers in school were not talking about gay rights, they were talking about feminism. And this album that was very feminist and by Marlo Thomas had a song about a boy that wanted to play with a doll, and that was me. I mean, that inclusion in something bigger that was more popular, you know?
And that was the song, and I don't know if you read anything in the background of it, but it, when I was getting ready to use the song, I went online and there was an interview by Marlo Thomas. I think it was on their 40th anniversary, just a few years ago, of the album. And she said William Wants a Doll was the one song that almost made it impossible to put on television.
Oh, wow.
Because
wow.
ABC felt it would emasculate men.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to put that. They wanted it on, but they didn't want that song on. So they were like, well, we like the rest of it. We just don't want William Wants a Doll.
I mean, it's just so interesting? Horrifying. I mean,
I know.
It just shows how corrupt. But that's the same thing today, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And it's like, there are boys that play with dolls that aren't even gay. And there are gay boys
totally.
That play sports. So
yeah.
why are you... It's like people are projecting their crap onto this, you know...
This kid. And like I say, and then the kid has to learn at a young,
yeah.
tender age, mm-hmm. I can't really be who I want to be.
Totally.
I have two lesbian friends that raised two straight kids. A son and a daughter. And the son, when he was little, wanted to wear a dress.
Yeah.
And she didn't know how to deal with it. And she mm-hmm. talked to her therapist. And the therapist said, oh, just let him wear a dress. And if you don't make an issue of it, it'll come and go.
Yeah.
But if you make an issue of it, it'll probably... turn into
yeah.
this big thing,
mm-hmm.
and you know he'll be talking
yeah.
about it, you know, when he's an adult and the rest of it. So it lasted like a week, and she
mm-hmm.
said, well, let's just draw boundaries around it. Let's start by just wearing it in the house and out in the yard and things like that before you go to school in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Meaning she was, you know, kind of like, if you want to go to school in a dress, you can go to school, but let's just start with it at home.
Yeah.
And then she said after about few days of it, he just didn't like it anymore, and then
yeah.
she said, started to notice it just went away, and she didn't say anything, and he didn't say anything, and you know, and you
cut
just,
to
oh
in 10
God.
Years he's
I could
doing
have been
the
a straight
Tuesdays,
man.
Wednesdays, and Thursdays
yeah.
at your house.
And I'm thinking, I could have been a straight guy with a wife and five kids probably if my mother had just allowed
right.
me to play with the dolls.
Well,
could have been a phase.
Or trans, you know? I mean, it really
right.
could go either way.
Exactly. No, and I was, like, gay as a goose as a kid, you know, clearly. And I know you guys probably were, too. Like,
oh, totally.
I was gay.
Well, my mom used to make
time.
Fun of me
oh,
for playing with
God.
My sister's Barbies. And
really?
Then, and then I was, like, in high school, and I was, like, in therapy, and I was, like, you made fun of me for playing with Barbies. And she said, well... I wasn't being homophobic. I just thought you were too old to play with dolls. And I'm like, but I wasn't going like, hold my widow baby. I was like, you
right.
bitch, you slept with my
right.
husband. Give me back that mink soul.
Right.
You know, don't tell me I was too old for that. I was 11.
Exactly.
You know?
It was
right.
just the beginning of your
It wasn't a boy
career.
Game, though, you know. And,
yeah. Oh,
or,
yeah.
And they,
my parents wouldn't even buy me a G.I. Joe.
Well,
and those
see,
were really
They were
big.
Smart because
yeah.
I had the G.I. Joes and I used them with the Barbies.
Totally.
Well, that was
it was a gateway
more,
doll.
Because the G.I. Joes, you know, had like pecs and like
oh, yeah.
some of them had like nipples and stuff.
Mm.
You know?
Nipples.
Yeah.
Oh my.
But you know, my parents, my dad's a pastor, my parents are very conservative.
Oh, really?
But they always let me play with dolls and they never, you know, thank the Lord, they never shamed me
yeah.
for it or anything. But it was so confusing when I would hang out with my little guy friends, you know, because
right.
they would be like, why are you...
Yeah.
Why are you bringing a doll to the pool? And
yeah.
I go, well, why not? You know?
Yeah.
So that's why. And then when I grew up, you know, and came out, then everything else changed.
And were your parents Protestants or?
Baptist.
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay. That's like
yeah.
the background I grew up
so.
With. Yeah. Yeah,
but they let me
so
dress
good.
Up and everything.
But that's so cool that they were able to just let that go.
Yeah.
That
yeah. I mean,
impressive.
I think, you know, they
if
kind
they're
of.
Conservative.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think it was
Ooh.
Also kind of denial. They were like, oh, this just means he's artistic and creative, which, you know, totally.
Which it did.
But,
yeah.
You know. Years later, the coming out kind of changed all that. But, you know, I always tell them, we have all these home videos of me, you know, dressing up in drag and playing out in the yard in my sister's dresses and stuff.
Yeah.
And,
oh, totally.
You know, I
me
say,
too.
Thank you so much for not shaming me for that, because that would have been so damaging. And
yeah.
You know,
are you able to have a relationship with them?
Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
I do, too.
Yeah.
I did, too.
As
like,
far as,
after about a year after I came out.
Yeah,
it
same.
All, like,
yeah.
settled down. And
now it's a little don't ask, don't tell, but, you know.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com.
Great expectations.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Yeah, and then my parents were fine with, like, a year after I came out, and they were, like, coming around. They came over to my boyfriend's house for Christmas because it was wonderful. An off year, so my brothers were all
an off place. Year.
An off year. We had on years and off years. It was an off year. So they came, yeah, they didn't have anywhere to go, and my boyfriend was, at the time, not able to go home. He was he was from Michigan originally, and he had to work, so he's like, well, I'll make a dinner, and he could cook like crazy. So he had this fabulous dinner for my mom and dad, and the next year, I think it was the next year, my mom and dad and aunt from California, they all came over. So yeah, so they came over and brought him a gift. And
did they ever see you perform? Know,
my father never saw me perform, but the weird thing about, I tell people this, kids, initially this, that it's so important to come out to your parents and to give them the space they need, because you're coming out, but they're coming out too.
Yeah, way, for sure. Know?
That's a very interesting way to put it.
Yeah, because I think sadly, and as gay men, you know, by the time we finally come out, especially men my age, which, you know, it was like, we all came out in our mid-20s, like 25, 26, all of us. Anybody in their late 50s pretty much all came out about the same time. I don't know what happened. We must have all gotten together. We were all through college. We had fucked around through college. We had done all that. So, I mean, we were active, but we really came out to our families in our mid-20s. And my family, and I always tell people, you know, by the time it, you want to come out, you just need to come out. And it's just, you're exasperated. And you're just like, I just have to do this. And you all have to, like, deal with this.
Yeah.
And what you don't realize is, in many cases, they do realize that, but they haven't spoken about it. And now suddenly it's on the table.
Yeah.
And they need to come out, too. And it might take them, I don't expect them to get over it in five minutes or 5 weeks or 5 months or maybe even 5 years. Who knows?
Well, and a therapist told me
you
once.
You just need time.
It's like they have to go through a grieving process because they're grieving who they thought you were, the life you're going to have, grandkids, all that, you know.
Yeah, and the kid they wanted you to be, even though they knew you weren't that kid.
Yeah, so they have to
now
go through
public.
All those stages.
And in my case, I came out to them, and then probably about, how many years later? Quite a few years later, I came out to them as a performer, you know. And by that point, the good news is I was doing theater work. And so I was doing my own cabaret shows, which they didn't know this, but the cabaret shows I did drag shows in bars only for like 6 months. And then I thought, I gotta get out of here, you know, I gotta start singing live.
And where was that?
That was at the Gay 90s in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis.
Amazing.
And it was a great time, too, because it was gay men, you know, it was 96. It was the year of 96 as I was in the bar. And then the year of 97, I started doing cabarets. And the cabarets were based on a Christian radio broadcast. So it was like Miss Richfield doing her Christian radio broadcast. You were in the audience, sort of like Garrison Keillor in A Prairie Home Companion. So you were seeing her, you know, record this, you know, on a cassette tape, you know, for broadcast later, you know. And, yeah, it was really fun. It was KLAP, you know, K Listen and Pray, you know. And it was every clap joke you've ever heard, right? You know, we hope the clap is a blessing in your life. We hope you share the clap with the family and friends. Like, every clap joke you could possibly interrupt. K Listen and Pray. And, yeah, and it was, like, tongue-in-cheek. We didn't do tons of religious stuff, per se, but it was funny. It was
so
a ride.
Funny.
And it was so... It worked there in the Twin Cities because there was a big Christian radio show there. I mean, KTIS was the big Christian. It was on Northwestern University, or Northwestern College, which was a Christian college. And then when I came here, I tried to bring it to Provincetown for my first year. It just didn't work as well because it's largely, you know, a Catholic Jewish thing. Yes. And that's a Protestant thing.
Right, right.
And then Catholic radio is just different. There is Catholic radio and Catholic TV, but it's just not the same as the evangelical.
Right.
So it didn't quite work. So then I just... got rid of it after a couple weeks and just did a variety show. But it was a super funny show. I had commercials.
That is so funny.
I had an announcer. I had a little Jewish one.
A little Jewish.
It was like only about 4'10", and she would play the piano. Yeah, and then I had two drag queens with me. And me. And so it was the five of, and an announcer, a little Italian guy, super handsome, and he would always wear a tuxedo, and he would, you know, do the announcing on the mic. And then, so the five of us, and we, in this tiny little stage, in a 99-seat theater, where it was so crowded, and it was tied to a bowling alley and a restaurant.
Oh my God.
So you could hear people bowl. And when you got, and they would have three shows a night.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was like, it was a good preparation for Provincetown, mm-hmm. and you would line up behind the bowlers and through the restaurant. And then
was it a gay restaurant? Or?
No, it was owned by a lesbian, and it had not been touched since like 1929. So it was this really amazing, cool old
what
bar.
A cool,
old
is it
restaurant.
Not there anymore?
Yeah, it's still there, and they still do
it's
shows.
The gay 90s?
No. The gay 90s was a bar downtown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is Bryant Lake Bowl, which is a.
I want to go.
Yeah, right, it's a great space.
It's in Minneapolis.
Still, yeah, it's a still.
I've never been
still there.
Visit.
It was not as great a neighborhood now with the neighborhoods come along and. It's become a really swanky place to live.
I went to rehab there, but I haven't been
oh,
back.
Oh, did you?
I need to go.
Well, you probably went to Pride, which is like out in the middle of nowhere. Did you go to Pride?
No, I went to Hazelden. In
oh,
San
God.
City.
That's even worse. That's like an hour and a half north.
Yeah.
Like, that is in the... Seriously, that is... You might as well, like, not be...
Well, I flew into Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Oh, God, know. But you drove for at least an hour
I
and
saw,
a half to get
I
there.
I saw, it's, yeah. But I saw the city, you know.
Wow.
The Maritime
like you would
station.
If you drove through
I
New
mean,
York.
But I
mean,
yeah. I saw that it was there.
Yeah, exactly. You didn't, yeah. I mean, it's just that's unfortunate. I mean, it's great. Hazelden's a great
It was what
place,
I needed
but,
it to be that month.
And that's the thing. Yeah, that was a home. I think it was a home. It was their vacation home or something, it seems like.
Oh, right. That is true.
It
that's
seemed like
the
it
house
was, and Hazel's Den was actually how they got the name.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually Hazel's Den. That, and I think it was the father or something that had come around and figured out, like, oh my God, I gotta quit drinking, and got busy and got recovered. And then, but that's the granddaddy of them all. That
that's
was the very
mothership,
first.
Mothership, they call it, yeah.
And mothership, and then Pride came along and others came along.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah, you can't turn around. You can't swing a dead cat in Minneapolis of hitting somebody in sobriety.
There's a lot of places there, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of places.
But I want
a lot of
to,
people stay, which is nice.
I know. I have friends
they
from
have
New York who went and then still live there.
Yeah, because it's like people go back and forth, and then they realize, I can't keep going back to my home. I have to. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they just spend a few years there, and then they can transition back. But you kind of got to get back into a normal state of life where you don't have all the connections, which...
Yeah.
Unfortunately, my demon was alcohol, so
yeah.
I never got into the drugs, thank
no.
God.
Mm,
or I wouldn't be talking to you right now because I would have killed myself because that I would not have been able to stop.
Yeah.
I just would have used until I died. Mm. You know, as it was, alcohol was tough enough to hang up.
You know, it's also you don't know how you respond to different things. I mean, I'm such an addictive personality, but I drank every day. I never wanted to do drugs every day, though. I did drugs recreation. I mean, I abused them.
I just didn't have money.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing too.
I just did not have money, and I was so aware that I was poor that I knew better than to get into a habit.
Yeah,
I thought I dare not do this because I saw other people. I had friends that got into a lot of trouble with it, and I literally. Never, I smoked pot.
Yeah.
Never bought it.
Yeah.
Always smoked other people's weed.
Smart.
You know, never bought it. That tells you a little bit about me right there. And, you know, drank at bars where I could get some free booze. And, you know, I just never had any money. So I was like, phew.
Well, our business, there's a lot of free booze in our business. You know?
It is crazy. And a lot of people, you know, would say, how on earth can you be, you know, sober and be in your business? And it's like, you need to maintain your sobriety. You need to pay attention to your sobriety because it is like in your face all the time and in a way that's kind of good.
I actually don't know how people are in this sort of like entertainment nightlife business without, I mean, certainly people that have an actual addiction that's active. I mean, it's one thing, you know, people like, you know, that just drink for fun and don't have a problem. But I wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes. I mean, I would not have lasted
The only reason I've lasted is I started later. You know, I didn't start my career full time until I was 41. Mm-hmm. My previous work was journalism and public relations.
Yeah.
Which you also could, well, journalism, you could definitely drink in journalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, people drank in the office sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, because you were working such odd hours and so forth. Yeah. So it wasn't unusual for someone to, you didn't get drunk in the office, but, you know, you have a cocktail or a beer or something while you're working late at night, just because that's what you would do at home, you know, or someplace else. So it was drinking through that and then getting into entertainment, really kind of, and then working here in P-Town was the absolute, that's what finally drove me into the ground, because you don't drive.
Yeah.
You know, and I drove drunk all the time, which was a horrible thing. You know, I would take the world's safety into my own hands, my own impaired hands, and not care, right? Mm-hmm, you know, and you know how it goes. The drunk always lives, you know, and how I didn't kill someone or hurt someone, right? It's a God moment. And so that is part of what keeps me sober, is I just know I will drive if I drink.
Yeah.
Like I do. Mm-hmm. I cannot draw a line, and I will get behind the wheel and I will drive. And I have one DWI, but, you know, I don't know how I ended up with not multiple, but whatever it was like, I was able to like sort it out. You know, I always say, you know, with the help of AA, Jesus in the state of Minnesota.
Well,
I'm not drinking these days.
I know a lot of the RuPaul girls talk about getting off the show, and you know, before the show they had no money and they were performing in their little small town clubs, and they get on the show and all of a sudden they're on tour and they're famous and everything's offered to them, and a lot of them have to learn how to say no, or you know, I think Alaska got sober or something. It's like that's
and
part of the
journey.
And how
you do that as a young person is impressive.
Yeah, so hard.
Totally. Yeah. I was 35 when I got sober. I don't know how. When I meet kids who have real drug problems at 22 and they have to get sober or they're going to die.
Yeah.
But I needed all those years of research, you know? I mean, I absolutely...
Mm-hmm. Oh, I would have totally wasted my career if I had become, you know, if I had been able to perform here in my 30s, I would have just ruined it.
Yeah.
As it was, I almost destroyed it. But I got sober in 09. Mm-hmm. And so the 09 summer was clean. Mm-hmm. And then, so I guess I had 6 years of... So I've officially got more years clean than I have.
Yeah.
And it's a super fun place to drink, you know.
Yeah.
And tie one on and have fun if you can do it.
Yeah,
I'd say more power to you. You don't have to, you can walk back to your B&B and have a slice of pizza on the way home.
Totally.
You know, it's like.
Pizza.
So I encourage it. I'm like, have fun, you know, if you can do it. I, you know, had to hang it up. That doesn't mean everyone does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I, you know, my boyfriend drinks normally, you know. So once in a while he ties one on and normally, you know, has one cocktail and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes I relate more, or it's easier to relate to someone who doesn't have a problem than to someone who either has an active addiction or is in recovery, you know, because it's just kind of, what I relate to is the addiction, not the actual drug, you know.
Yeah.
But in terms of that, on a bigger scale, not just in terms of drugs and alcohol, but the community of being in P-Town, where, I mean, it's such a unique situation that you're here with all these other artists, some of them we've really come up with over all these years, and then the people that are coming in for a gig for 2 nights or 2 weeks or whatever, you know, each summer. I know that there's kind of a territorial thing between the different presenters and club owners, but it seems like there seems to be more of like a sense of community among the artists, especially you guys that are really the stalwarts.
It's interesting, and really something I look forward to every year is the community of performers. And generally, we don't, nobody steps on anyone's dress, you know, everyone stays back. And we all have lunch at different times, so it's common that... It's rare. I should say it's rare that I don't have lunch with almost everybody. It seems like it just, you know, you go by people and they're like, oh, we haven't had lunch yet. You know, let's figure something out. So at the end of the summer, you're having like 5 lunches a week at least. You have a lunch out every day trying to like catch up. And we see each other's shows. It's generally a very supportive situation. The only tough thing is that can be, because people rely on it financially, and so if someone's having a bad summer or something like that, it can get to be tough because there is a lot of competition, and some people do better than other people do, and there's a sense, which I would feel, you know, and I did feel back in the day. Varla used to sell out every night, and I would go to the box office and have eight tickets sold. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I would have to build the crowd, you know, and I'd end up with 48.
Yeah.
But it wasn't 115.
Yeah.
You know, and he would just ride his bike down the street and park it and get off and go in. And I'm thinking, how does that feel? Mm. And now I can do that sometimes. Yeah. I don't do it all the time, but I can do it sometimes where I can just ride through town and pull in. And
how many shows a week do you do now?
I do 5 a week for the main part of the season. Mm-hmm. So I do anywhere from, I think this year I did 58 here, and then, but I've done as many as 64. Mm-hmm. Then I do a couple on the road. Mm-hmm. So I do one up in Kennebunk at the Vinegar Hill Music Theater. Mm-hmm. Then I do one in Rehoboth Beach at the Blue Moon. Okay. And you guys probably know.
I still haven't been there. I'm dying.
Oh, you still haven't been down there? Oh, it's a fun place. And it's interesting because it's a completely different vibe. You know, they have a really beautiful beach right at the end of town, so it's really easy to get to, as opposed to our beach, which is like, you really have to make a commitment to go to that gay beach.
I've still never been.
Yeah, I don't even think of this as a beach town.
It isn't
here.
Really.
I see shows, I eat, I walk, I go to the pool, you know.
Right, buy art. It's like tons of art, you know, in the community. I always buy a piece of art every year.
Oh, I
love
that.
Yeah, and somebody encouraged me to do that a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be a cheap, like, you know, $10 thing, or it can be like a $2,000 thing, you know. I mean, obviously, you pace that out, but yeah, I always make sure I get a piece of art here.
This is such an artsy town.
It is.
I was watching the Sopranos the other day, and there's this bit where she has a piece of artwork hanging in her office, the therapist, and he's like, "I like that painting." She's like, "Oh, thanks, I got it in Provincetown."
Oh, I love
Dr. Melfi.
Dr. Melfi, yeah.
Oh, hooray. Oh, I didn't
that's
know that.
That's wonderful. We should make a video of that.
Yeah,
a meme. What do you call it? A vine?
Right.
Not a vine.
Got it in Provincetown. Oh, I love that. Yeah, there's some really, it's just fun to have some, and it's a lot of it's locally done.
Yeah.
So, and
we're saying, also, the shopping here is so wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
So we go to Fire Island a lot, and there's like one store, you know.
Yeah.
Here, it's like you can really have
and
some
I've
fun.
And I've never been to, I've been to the Pines, but I've never been to the Grove.
The Cherry Grove.
Have
and
you performed?
Said that's really fun.
Well, the Grove is a little bit, I mean,
it's city-ish, right?
It's not Provincetown, but it is, it's a more relaxed, mixed atmosphere than the Pines, and there are, I guess, three different, at least, bars where you can go see a drag show. I mean, and they're not the kind of things that you buy admission to, but there's a drag queen there, we actually interviewed her for the podcast, too, Pixie Aventura. Who's brilliant.
I have not met her, but I've heard of
her.
She's
so funny. Hedda
Lettuce
so smart.
Used to do, always did Cherry Grove.
Yes, Hedda's there all the time, and it's great. Yep. You know, and it's a different thing. I mean, it's about the tips, and people walk in and walk out, but there's also people like us who are like, we're here to see the show.
Yeah.
We got there early, we're staying to the end, we're in it, you know. And it's pretty cool, but I mean, they've started branching out, like, in the Pines we saw, they brought, like, they had Shangela do July 4th weekend, and Lady Bunny did some stuff, and
Bunny.
And, you know, but it's a little, it's just not, Bunny can sell, and you guys would actually do well, because...
Well, it's the same season. That's the problem.
That's right. Yeah.
We're on the same season.
But, I mean, you could go, if you're doing five shows a week here, you could go down there for two nights.
I tried that one time.
Pine, I think.
I did the Pines party one time.
Exactly, that's perfect.
And it was, like, the most insane thing I've ever done.
Sure.
Next to going down, I went to North Carolina, what's that called? The Outer Banks. Went to the Outer Banks or South Carolina. I'm not sure which one it is, but the Outer Banks. I mean, it was really cool. It was a really great place, but oh my word, trying to get down there and back was like, and New York, you know, so you have to, I have to get into Logan or get into Boston, either take the train to New York or fly.
Yeah.
And then you got to get to Penn Station. And
we're trying something new tomorrow
because
we're going straight to the Pines.
Schlep.
And we're taking three boats. Because we're taking the ferry to Boston, train to Bridgeport, ferry from Bridgeport to Port Jefferson, Long Island.
Oh, that's
an
smart.
An Uber to Sayville, Long Island, and then the ferry to Fire Island.
That is smart, though. I think
it sounded smart, but now that I keep looking at the actual door-to-door transportation time, it might not be that smart. But I will let you know what our take on this mode was.
See how long that takes.
Yeah.
That's intriguing.
I mean, I'm sure this is a lot of money, but I saw someone recently posted there's a plane, like a really small plane you can take from the Cape to Islip, I think.
Oh. Yeah.
And then you can
from
take...
From the Cape to Islip? From Hyannis, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe. I didn't know that.
And then you can take just a car straight to Sydney.
That would be amazing.
I mean, I'm
well,
sure
maybe the podcast does well, and we'll do that.
You know, like, keep
we'll be
going
like, Russ,
this.
Come on, we've got the private jet. Right. Just come down for a night.
You'll be fine. Just bring a light outfit and light shoes.
Oh, my God.
Because it's a plane, right? Yeah. Like they...
You don't want to have the blood circulation and your feet get crazy.
Yeah. I'll just come and drag and then just show up. But we had a great time. And I love the people down there. It was super fun. The Pines Party was great, of course.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But, oh, my gosh, just get down there and back was, like, everything I could do in a couple days. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, Hedda loaned me, or did she find, I think she gave me that dress, which I think I ended up retiring finally because I had worn it so many times. It was one of her green dresses.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I needed a green dress for that Pines Party. I'm just remembering that. So, yeah, thank you, Hedda Lettuce,
for
being gracious.
It goes beyond the actual...
Yeah, and she was in Provincetown, and I said, oh, you know, I need a green dress. I don't have a green... You know, and it was before Amazon.
Yeah.
Now you would just go onto Amazon, but I did. I went to Hedda, and Hedda just like, here you go.
I
was like,
that.
She has an extra green dress.
She's
4'10". She's the green lady, so she gave me a dress. Oh, I've forgotten all about that. It was a good memory. And we had a great time, but oh my God, I can't do... And, you know, you do so well here financially that it's really hard to leave.
Of course.
Because you really do well here. It's, you know, even if you don't sell that many tickets, you still can do... Mm-hmm. I mean, back in the day when I didn't sell that many tickets, it's like, I felt like I'm the king of the world, you know, like... I would leave town. I would have paid my credit card off. I would,
amazing.
And then I started staying in hotels, you know, so I didn't have to drive all 1,500 miles in one fell swoop.
Mm.
So now I only go 500 miles, and I stay in two hotels, and I mean...
Oh, because you've got all your crab with you.
And I have all my crab with me and the two cats. Yeah. Two different cats.
Now. Oh, you have the cats
those
here
cats
with
have
you?
Died, but yes, I bring my cats with
that.
Me. I always have two cats, you know.
I love
just
cats.
You have to have two.
Does your boyfriend come out for the summer?
He
too?
Does, and he's allergic to cats, so that's the only problem we've got to get over. But he manages.
Does
he
take
medicates himself?
Claritin or something?
He does, and I'm trying to get him to see if he can get those shots because there's like shots you can get. Which, but my brother was deathly allergic to cats, and ended up marrying a woman with two cats, and then one died, and they got another cat to replace that cat, and he loves the cats, so it's like,
what would you?
I think you can. I think you can. Get acclimated, or at least acclimated to those cats.
So funny.
So I'm hoping.
Growing up, still does perform some, but my granddad was a touring country western singer. And
no
so,
way! I love country western.
Yeah, it was like old school, like Marty Robbins, Gene Autry, Patsy Cline, that type of stuff. But my sister and I would travel with him and my grandmother all the time across the country to all his shows. And they would always bring their two cats.
Oh.
And the cats were so... They had this big conversion van, and the cats were so, like,
used to it.
Tame and wonderful that they just, like, laid on the dashboard the whole trip and just looked out the window.
Amazing.
But we'd have to sneak them into the hotel, you know, because some of the hotels didn't take pets.
Yes.
So that was, like, my sister and my job was to put them in, like, little pillowcases.
Sure.
And, you know,
which you could do pretty easily. The only thing is that then you have to keep them away from windows.
Keep them away from windows and then just make sure the maids never go in. You know, we always kept the do not disturb sign.
Because if you clean up after, I mean, I leave the room cleaner than I left it, you know, because I'm so concerned.
Yeah.
So I have the lint brush that I, you know, make sure the bedspread's all cleaned off and, you know, there's nothing... But I have stay in the same places that take pets, so every time it's the same routine. But I just have to have my pets with me.
Oh, that's so cute.
But I don't take them on the road with me otherwise, because I'm traveling to shoot. Yeah.
What, do you have any New York gigs coming up in the...
I don't anytime soon. I think I will in the spring. I usually go to the Triad, which
I think I saw you there last summer, maybe? Were you there last summer or two summers ago? Last spring.
Yeah,
so
probably
funny.
April or something like that.
I love the Triad. It is
so
beautiful.
It's a great space.
People think it's going to be a cabaret room, and it's like this beautiful, ornate theater.
Yeah, it's like a mini vaudeville theater.
Yeah,
it's so New York-based. You have to go into that restaurant.
Yeah,
first of all, you see the sign. Then people are trying the doors, and, like, and then they step back, and they look again. You're just like, just go into the restaurant.
Totally.
So they go up the stairs, and then it's not... quaint at all. Like that little area
you
walk up to is
not. It just seems like a.
And then you open the door
theater.
And you walk into this.
It's so beautiful.
Like,
jewel
really
box.
Old.
Jewel box
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
And they were gonna, I think they were gonna close it years ago.
Years
and
the
oh
name
God.
Changes and then it goes back.
They hung in
I
there.
Like when they go back to being the Triad. That's what I, when it was first, when Forbidden Broadway was there, it was the Triad.
And see, I don't even know the whole history. I just know a verbal history of it. They've also got it set up with six cameras. And there's a guy there who has a switcher in the green room So if you ever want your show show recorded, every year I pay him anywhere from like $500 to $600, and it's like 6 cameras.
Amazing.
So, fabulous. Yeah, so when I'm out in the audience, no, I just get them more for my own, you know, benefit. But it's so much better than just having somebody in the back of the room with a
camera. Should sell them. But like,
oh, you'd have to get rights to music. And yeah, it would be expensive. True.
But like, that would be so wonderful to like have you on Netflix or Amazon Prime or something.
It's
like, you know?
Amazing. For I would tell my friends in New York, like, get a gig there if you want your show really recorded well. He does a beautiful job. He watches it. He sometimes will watch it at home. He doesn't even come in. And then the next day, he just comes in and he sits there with a switcher. So at the end of the show, you've got it. He doesn't do any editing. Also, he does it all on the fly.
Wow.
And he knows where all the cameras are, so he's just switching. He's got his television switcher in the back. Up, you know, he's not even in the same room with you.
I want to get an internship with him. I could learn how to be a TV director.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's very Desi Arnaz.
Whoever he is, he's like, and I'm not sure I've ever met him. It seems like, I think I did once, but last year he came and did it, and I never even saw him. Like, he just, I didn't even know. And like, were you here? Did that? And he's like, oh yeah, I recorded it. It was great. It was, you know, great night. You're on fire. And like, right.
And you certainly were when I saw you.
Oh, God. You're so, was I?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've seen you so many times.
The only
but
problem with, you know, really relying on crowd interaction is, you know, sometimes it can crash and burn. Yeah. It doesn't usually crash and burn, but there
That's the thing. You're so, no one works with
moments.
An audience like you do. You know, you really know
the
how
one
to
that
read
Varla Jean Merman came to, of course, this year was one of only like two. The other one that didn't go so well, Seth Rudetsky and Frank DeCaro were at. Only two shows the entire summer of like 58 shows that were like, you know, where it's like, you're just working,
well,
trying to get people.
They all understand the day to day back and forth.
Thank God. And, you know, they're totally gracious, but I'm thinking, oh, God, this is going so much better if you would just come on a night.
Isn't that always the way it is, though?
Oh, always.
When somebody that you want there is,
and
you know,
I even, like, know that that could happen, so I, like, divorce myself of expectations and think, I'm just going to be what it's going to be. But then at the end of it, you're like, wow, how does that happen every time?
Can you tell immediately when you go out on stage that night? On a night like that, if the energy's off?
I try to not do that because you can kind of get yourself into a funk. Mm-hmm. And my lighting guy, my spotlight guy who's worked with me for, like, 10 years here, he can tell too, because the video at the beginning has images of like me as a little girl and you know, me with you know, the dictator from North Korea and me with Jesus walking on water.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a lot of funny images in it, and if nobody laughs, that's when it's like, oh God.
Yeah.
You know, it just can be deadly. And you go out and then sometimes the whole thing will just turn around. Like, you'll just be fine. And then other times it's like, okay. And if I'm fine unless it let it affect me. I can just keep the persona on, which is really the professional thing to do. And when it gets to you, you're just not being professional.
Right.
And that happens.
Yeah.
And so you're like,
I mean,
shit.
Just the every time I've seen you, it's hard to imagine anything throwing you because it seems like Miss Richfield is in the room. So anything that happens, you're responding as Miss Richfield. So we're delighted by you having to deal with
well,
it.
Well, the secret to it, and my guy that does lighting is like, oh my God, that is so true, is if you get off to a weird start, it sort of can be a weird evening. Mm-hmm. It's so weird. Like, if you talk to one person and they're a little off, and you can't, or they won't, like, give you information or something, and then it's like, you can go through an entire evening where you just can't get information from people. It's just, and I think it's just natural. I think that's just, we kind of follow each other.
Were there performers you saw live that had that kind of audience interaction that
never
you were inspired by?
Never. I never saw that before.
How did you get so good at it?
I don't know if I'm necessarily good at it.
I mean,
I
think you're the master at
truly.
That.
I mean,
how I do it is I started because I worked in that drag show.
Yeah.
And I had to stand up in front of people for like 20 minutes and start the show. And you know, it was supposed to be like a 15-minute thing. So I would do a number and then talk. And then I was supposed to introduce the first person. So it was only supposed to have maybe like 10 minutes at the most. But even 10 minutes is a long time to stand up in front of people. Especially when you don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah.
And I had no preparation. I mean, none. You know, I had just gotten the gig. I had performed a couple times. And then this guy couldn't be there on a Saturday. And he goes, why don't you fill in for me? You would be funny. You have such a different sort of character. And So, I mean, I had three different voices. By the time I was done, I didn't know, did I talk with an accent? Did I talk, you know, because I had not developed anything. But, you know, I think it's that being able to just show up and do the work. And I would talk to people because it was like, well, who do we have here tonight? You know, like, oh, great. Well, you know, and talk to people that you always see. Talk to people that are new, you know, and anybody, you know, like, are there any parents here? Some guy would have brought his parents in or something, you know. So you could visit with people. And I remember one of the first times I did it, I was at the bar getting a drink, of course. And, the bartender who knew exactly what I drank. And so I was, you know, hustling through the room trying to get that. And it was packed. And the guy standing at the bar looked at me and said, are you the one that's emceeing the show? And I said, yeah. And at the time, I wore different wigs. So it was kind of, I think he was kind of having a hard time telling. Because it was a brown wig instead of a black wig. And before I really developed the look.
Yeah, the iconic.
I said, yeah, the iconic. Before I learned, like, okay, people have to recognize you. So I said, yeah, I am. And he goes, wow, yes, you're really funny. You're like a comedian. It's great. You know? And I just remember thinking, God. I had just never let that in. And I'd only done it a few times, and I thought, oh, no, this guy thinks I'm a comedian. Like, wow, this is amazing, you know? And so I never, and again, if I had to do it again, I probably would go to improv classes or something because that would have actually probably helped me and refine it faster. But I just sort of went by the school of hard knocks, which I would not suggest because I think there are really cool training programs that can really help you and get you over the hump faster. But I just sort of learned it as I went, not even knowing there were improv classes. No one told me. And there's improv classes in Minneapolis, right down the block from where I was performing. I had no clue. Dudley Riggs runs a big, you know, school. So anyway, I just did it, and I was like, and then one of the things I was taught, though, at from somebody who did that, is they said, oh, one of the things you'll learn in improv is to keep going. You can't stop. And it was yeah, exactly. And see all this shit that I didn't know. And so that's what, and then that's really helped me in uncomfortable situations where you get into an uncomfortable situation, you uncover, my most uncomfortable thing I ever did is I uncovered that this guy, this young guy, he was only probably like 24 years old and cute as a bug's ear, he's with his fiance and her mother. And the show I was doing was called, it was at the Art House at the time, Miss Richfield Flies Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And the whole basis of the show was once I did the opening number and everything, and then I say, okay, lock the doors. And you hear this crazy locking mechanism and rolling and chains and, you know, locked. And I said, because this is an intervention. You know, you're all here because your families have, you know, and so it was a great idea, right? And then I would ask the person's name, and I had a book, you know, and I would flip through the book and go, okay, you know, and I would pretend to, like, look the person's name up. Okay, Tim, it's your last initial. Okay. So, you know, and then I would go off on a tear with this person.
Wow.
So his tear was that his mother had sent him, right? And so I would always try to pick kind of a younger person and a guy, if I could, a straight guy. So I'd pick this guy. And for whatever reason, I asked him where his mother lived. And I never asked that. I would always, and that's another thing, don't fucking go on some weird tangent. And it was like, I'd just be like, now, what's your mother's name? You know, and he'd say Linda or something. Okay, Linda. Now, where, you know, and then I would just go on. Well, I actually asked where this guy's mother lived. And he said, oh, and he sort of stuttered. And he was a real nice guy. He goes, well, she just passed. And he was young. So, I mean, like, this woman had to be, like, probably 50.
Oh,
like when she died. I mean, you know, you're doing the math in your head, like, oh, this woman died, you know, not like some, not like us. If we said my mother died, you know, she's probably in her 80s, you know, like of old age, you know. And I was like, oh, no. And the crowd, it was like, and I've never had anything like it, thank God, before or since. It was like every ounce of oxygen was sucked out of that.
Oh, my God, like, I'm getting butterflies just thinking about it.
Oh, and the, and
well, you like, had to do it thinking, so you would learn.
Keep going, keep going.
Yes,
and so I'm talking, and I'm like, oh, well, it couldn't have been her that contacted me then. It must have been somebody else. And but I said, you know, someone, but you're here for a reason, da-da-da-da-da. And I kept going. I didn't stop. And I could feel the sweat going down my back.
Oh,
and that had never happened before. And I'm like, holy shit, I am sweating. And the whole back of me was just wet from, like, I was wet from, like, the eyebrows down, you know, from like just stress. Nerves.
You had to have that happen. I mean...
And fortunately, the guy who owned the property at the time, Ben DeRider, was there, and he was like, man, I will never... Every time he talks to me, he recounts that. You know, we only see each other, like, once a year, and he goes, God, you know, every so often, I think back to that time that I saw you do that with that kid whose mother died. And he goes... Man, that is when I knew you were a professional, that you could get yourself out of that, because he goes, the room was like, and it wasn't a big crowd, it was like kind of like half full, so it was maybe, you know, and how that goes, that's even worse, you know. And then there was a point at the in the show where I had, because it was all therapy, so I had these dolls that represented these people, right? So one of them was your pastor called me, one of them was your boss called me, and one of them was your mother called me. So I had these dolls dressed up like these different people. So in my mind, I'm like, somehow I'm going to have to get this guy around, because I was too far into it to pick somebody else. And so I'm like, because then we have this thing where we do this number where we hit the dolls, you know, to like get the anger out, you know.
It's like First Wives Club.
Oh, it's hilarious. It was a hilarious number. But the whole time I'm talking to him and my mouth is going, and I'm just like, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do? And I came back to him when I needed to bring him back up on stage for that. And I said, oh, I reread my notes. I read them too quickly. It's your mother-in-law who's there. Why I didn't think of that right away, you know, I mean, that would have been a quick thing. Like, it wasn't your mother. It must have been her. That would have been helpful.
Well, you were horrified.
I was so horrified. And it's just like how I, like, managed to not, I don't know, melt into a ball and, like, quit performing for the rest of my life. It was so traumatic.
Thank God you did it.
Thank God
God you lived to tell
about it. Thank God I lived to tell about it. But that's, like, one of... several horrifying experiences that you have, and you just like,
everyone has,
but you don't
stores.
Stop. And I'm sure you guys in your plays and musicals and everything have had, you know, you get in the middle of a number and I'm crazy.
Not me, I've been blessed.
Right, not everyone but you, Ben. You know, the rest of us.
We play a game with all of our guests. All
right.
Which is called Dolly Concert Kill.
In the vein of Mary Fuck Kill.
I don't even know that.
So that game is where we would say three people and you choose which one to marry, which one to fuck, and which one to kill.
Oh, that one.
We'll give you three
guys
or whatever.
Or cliff, people call it, who you push off a cliff. But so in this version, we'll give you three performers.
Okay.
You want to know which one you'd like to see as Dolly Levi and Hello Dolly.
Oh.
And which one you'd see in concert and which one you would kill.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, so
we have to do Marlo Thomas and Varla,
Varla,
I think.
Oh, yes.
And then
the third one be...
Dina Martina?
We could keep it a P-Town Potpourri.
We could keep it a P-Town Potpourri.
I was going to say Carol Channing, because she's on much of that.
I'm trying to think of who else we could...
So, the very next time you happen to be just sitting there quietly watching TV and you see some nice lady who smiles as she scours or scrubs or rubs or washes or wipes or mops or dusts or cleans, remember, nobody smiles doing housework but those ladies you see on TV. Your mommy hates housework. Your daddy hates housework. I hate housework too. And when you grow up, so will you. Because even if the soap or detergent or cleanser or cleaner or powder or paste or wax or bleach that you use is the very best one, housework is just no fun. Children, when you have a house of your own, make sure when there's housework to do that you don't have to do it alone. Little boys, little girls, when you're big husbands and wives, if you want all the days of your lives to seem sunny as summer weather, make sure when there's housework to do that you do it together.
Who are there any other big influences for you? Stars,
well,
singers?
Two big people that Miss Richfield always upholds. And one is Vonda K. Van Dyke, who was Miss America 1965. And she was the only Miss America in the history of Miss Americas to win both the title and Miss Congeniality. Because usually Miss Congeniality goes to a nice gal who's clearly not going to win, right?
Yeah.
And Vonda K. Van Dyke won both. And she's the only one in the history of Miss America, which is huge. And she did a ventriloquist act.
Oh my God.
And she only had one lung. I mean, it's just... It,
Vonda.
I mean, oh Vonda is it. And she's still alive today, to this day.
God bless
her. Never met her. And then, I take that back. I met her once, but it was before I started doing drag. The other person, yes, it was long gone, is Virginia Christine, who played Mrs. Olson on the Folgers commercials.
Oh, wow.
And that's a bit Miss Richfield, you know. And that's her so hometown of Stanton, Iowa, transformed their water tower into a coffee pot in her behalf.
That's
her
beautiful.
Honor.
That is amazing.
Clearly, like, how many people can say that?
Yeah. Well, I think not she needs to be on the list. Virginia Christine.
Virginia Christine would be.
Along with
And she was also in Look Who's Coming to Dinner. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Whatever.
The movie?
Yeah. What is it? What? Who, look Who's Coming with Katharine Hepburn and Hepburn Spencer and, Tracy mm-hmm. and Sydney Portney.
Sydney Portney.
Remember that? Mm-hmm. And she was the evil lady with the cigarette.
Oh, I haven't
If you watch that movie again, that was Virginia Christine, and she was, you know, like, oh, I can't believe that you're having that young man in your house. And she, you get out of here. No, she was like, get in your car and drive. Going, Virginia Christine.
Oh my God, now I'm dying to watch this.
All right, so, okay, so Virginia,
Virginia,
Marla,
and Marlo.
And Marlo.
And Marlo, okay. Yes.
Virginia, Marlo.
Okay, so now I have to decide who I want to see in a concert.
Yeah.
Concert, who, Dolly Levi on Broadway.
Dolly Levi. And that's the concert one, Dolly Levi, right?
No, there's two. One is for Dolly Levi, one is for a concert, and one is to die.
To die.
Concert, cabaret show, whatever that means to
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, this is going to be easy, because Varlo, I would want to see as Dolly Levi.
Okay.
I mean, that would just be...
Yeah,
what?
So funny.
Although, I don't know, when you told me about the coffee pot and the water tower, I was picturing Virginia coming down
the stairs.
I
didn't know Virginia Christine could sing, I'm not sure.
I mean, you know, Dolly is not the hardest singer.
Right, but I think Miss Richfield, what I think Miss Richfield would say, if I was
yes.
Miss Richfield, uh-huh. which I'm not, clearly, but if
well,
I was...
Well, Miss Richfield would want herself to be Dolly.
Miss Richfield, right, she would have a hard time envisioning anyone... You know, doing anything you know that she didn't do, but first, but I think she would want to see Varla do Dolly Levi because
yes.
that would just be such a perfect thing for Varla. And then I think in concert, I would mm-hmm. love to see Marlo Thomas
mm-hmm.
because I think mm-hmm. she would be or in a cabaret or something.
Yeah, yeah.
interesting
yeah.
to see her and then have
totally.
Her.
She
I would
do some
fold
of these
it,
numbers.
Yeah, and fold it in, do some of her stuff, and then talk about that girl and talk about
mm-hmm.
her the women's movement and talk about St. Jude and talk
her
about
dad.
Her father
yeah.
and growing
Phil
up
Donahue.
In show business. I know
so
they're
much.
Still married. They got married in 80, I think, and
wow.
they're still married. So, but I would love to see her in a cabaret, and then Virginia Christine would be the one. Who
she's dead
want.
Anyway.
I think she's dead anyway.
So it's it
she's already
out.
Dead.
You didn't have
Perfect.
To kill anybody.
I didn't have to kill anyone. And Miss Richfield would not want to kill anyone.
That was a class act. That was a lesson in everything.
Yay! Oh,
yes,
I wish we didn't have to set the bar up. Otherwise, we could talk all afternoon.
We'll come back.
We'll have to turn the ice
again.
Machine back on.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah,
oh, God,
we should do that before that.
Well, thank you. You're wonderful.
No,
thank
you,
Miss Russ,
guys.
Miss Richfield. People can follow you on social media.
Yes,
correct?
I have Facebook, and I have an Instagram that I'm finally trying to like do on a regular basis. My manager really handles Facebook, but you can always contact me through that, and we don't post a lot, but a little bit.
And
then I have my
videos.
Website, MrChill.com, mm-hmm. and like I said, the Instagram.
YouTube.
The YouTube. Mm-hmm. Miss Richfield doesn't have a YouTube right now until she can buy one at Walgreens.
She'll find it.
When she No, but actually if you go to my website, it has a little button that says my VHS tapes. If you hit that, it takes you to the YouTube.
Love,
yes.
Love,
all right.
Love.
Well,
the
thank
internet.
You.
Love you.
Russ, Miss Richfield.
This is an honor.
Yes.
Thank you guys.
Oh,
this
you
is
are.
A word. I mean,
we're
you know,
so
like,
honored.
We're
just.
We're such fans and we're so excited for the
well,
listeners to join
so
us.
Thank you so much. You guys are so beautiful.
Thanks for listening to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World. For more episodes, visit Broadway World, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts do be.
Come back next week as we conclude our special Winter in a Summertown mini-season with four-time Tony nominee Judy Kuhn, who will be chatting with us live from BroadwayCon.
Judy's coming in to chat about Joni Mitchell's landmark 1971 album, Blue.
Our new season begins February 10th with Tony Award winner Lena Hall coming in to talk about Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction.
After Lena, we'll be chatting with Drew Drogie, Allison Fraser, and Nathan Lee Graham.
This episode was recorded at the Pilgrim House in Provincetown. Visit them online at pilgrimhousepetown.com.
This episode was edited by me, Daniel Nolan.
Thanks to Emmy-winning composer and lyricist Lance Horn for the Broken Records theme song.
Follow us both, Ben Rimmelauer and Daniel Nolan, on all y'all's socials.
That's Ben Rimmelauer. BenRimmelauer.
And that's Nolan with an E, not Nolan with an A.
Because Nolan with an A is an ass.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.